Thanks very much for having me. Thank you, Rowan, for that kind introduction. Mark, Stephen, the Global Labor Research Center, for helping bring me out here to your fair city, your hot city. We have a small enough group, actually. If I could just ask people, just if you go around, just introduce yourselves in sort of one very quick, you know, question you came in with today or a thought that you came in with today.
I'll start. Mark Thomas, as I mentioned, I'm director of the Global Labor Research Center and a professor in sociology here at York. And I guess my question is, how do workers fight Trump? Uh-huh. From an American perspective, I guess.
My name is Jordan Hose. I'm coordinator of the Global Labor Research Center. And a question that I would have would be, given the victories of Fight for 15 in Seattle and Ontario, what is the pivot? How does the Fight for 15 movement move forward?
Great.
My name is James, and I work for the Faculty Association at York. And I'm interested in the ways that the Fight for 15 movement in the United States is reshaping the labor movement, the American labor movement.
I guess I'm curious to know if we can expect a backlash against Fight for 15, not only from business, but from some labor unions, as there was a backlash against minimum wage laws by labor in previous decades.
My name is Garma. I'm a political science student. I guess I'm just interested in how this whole thing actually fits into globalization and where that's going from the trajectory.
Thank you.
My name is Kate. I'm from the Communication and Culture Program. So I study cultural labor, but I'm mostly just here out of curiosity. I don't have a specific thing.
My name's Tim. I'm a retired high school teacher and a member of Socialist Alternative, the organization that Sharma Salant in Seattle belongs to. And my question would be, how do you see the interplay, the connection between the movement in the streets in Seattle and other places, including Toronto, and how it gets expressed electorally, and I guess specifically in the States? I don't expect you to know all the nuances of Canadian electoral politics.
Hi, it's me again, Ramon from sociology. I'm just curious to learn about how the Fight for 15 movement can help us address the issues of racial justice and how to build broad coalitions across various communities.
Thank you. Those are great questions and points, and hopefully we'll get to it either in my presentation or through the discussion. I'm Jonathan Rosenblum. I think one thing I wanted to get out today is really learn about the status of your movement and what your assessment is of the struggle between workers and capital in Toronto and in Canada more generally, and see how we can urgently but over the long haul build closer ties between our movements. I got a lot of advice from friends in Seattle before I came here, and they said, well, if you're speaking at York University, it's an academia, you better bring data, not just political polemics. So I want to actually just start off in introducing a little bit more about who I am with some data points. This is U.S. private sector union density over the years, beginning in 1930, really to the present day. And the right side of that chart is actually 2015. Our union density used to be over 30%, 35%, and now it's much lower, as you can tell, and just by way of biography. This is about where I joined the U.S. labor movement as a rank and file worker in the newspaper industry in the early 1980s. And here I am offering you expert advice about how to save the labor movement. So you will have to judge the value of anything I have to say, but you would be forgiven if you are a bit skeptical. But in all seriousness, we all go through experiences, whether we win or lose struggles, and if we're good organizers, we learn from them. Sometimes you learn more from losses than victories. And then we need to share these experiences and come up collectively with how do we build a stronger movement in the long haul. I have some experiences that I'm going to share with you, but I don't regard them as sort of the gospel truth of the formula of how to build a labor movement, because if they were better ideas, if they were perfect ideas, we probably wouldn't see that chart right there. As I mentioned, I started out in the newspaper industry as a reporter, a rank-and-file member of the International Typographical Union in the 1980s. It was actually an open shop in upstate New York, and we had no dues checkoff in the contract. We had to go desk to desk every 2 weeks and hand collect dues, and so there was a continual organizing, because you always had to talk to your coworkers about why it was important to be part of the union, to be active, to be involved, and to support it. In 1984, I became an organizer for what became a service employees union affiliate, healthcare workers, first in New England, then traveling around the country for SEIU before finally settling in Seattle in 1991. And there I was the founding organizer for Washington State Jobs with Justice, labor, student, community, religious coalition, where we led a lot of direct action, civil disobedience, occupying corporate headquarters, taking over a NAFTA banquet, blockading streets to protest the WTO, and so on. In this time, I also worked for a while as a stagehand, assaulting various jobs and trying to organize them. Famously, got hired by and then fired by the Cirque du Soleil. Once, I can tell you about that later if you want, but we organized a strike and it was hugely successful. In the last 20 years, I've led multi-union organizing projects with the Labor Council, and then more recently served as senior staff with the SEIU Healthcare Union in Washington State. In 2011, I was asked by SEIU to lead a bold experiment to organize 4,000 low-wage workers at SeaTac Airport, the international airport outside of Seattle. And I was really privileged to lead this coalition of unions, community, and faith organizations in what became the first successful $15 minimum wage fight in the country. And as you know, it spread from there. And it's true that the book that you need to buy so that this gentleman can leave with an empty box today. It's true the book has my name on the cover, but the story really belongs to the workers. And I want to introduce you briefly to some of the people who carried this amazing story from imagination to reality. One of them is Sarah Mahmood. She was a 7-year-old girl when she escaped civil war in Somalia, hidden in the bed of a truck that lumbered across the Kenyan border to a refugee camp. Another is Asadola Valibieji. He struggled to make a living as a taxi cab driver and a merchant in the politically chaotic city of Tehran. Mohammed Kadim and his family fled bombings in Baghdad, only to land in Damascus just as war engulfed the Syrian capital. Now today, as you can imagine, all of these people would be unwelcome in the America of Donald Trump's dystopian mind. But fortunately, extremist xenophobia hasn't been my country's official policy in the last 20 years, at least until recently. And Mahmoud Valibieji and Kadim all made it to the US. And they're very meandering pathways through wars and refugee camps merged in the city of SeaTac. And in 2013, they united with their fellow workers, community members, and faith activists in the historic $15 minimum wage campaign wresting power from Alaska Airlines, the dominant airline at our airport, the Port of Seattle, which oversees the airport, and other corporate and political elites. I was really lucky to have worked alongside these and many other working class heroes, people whose creativity, wisdom, and perseverance fell outside the spotlight, but really built a model of a new kind of labor movement. Now for me, SeaTac was about a lot more than $15. It pointed the way towards social movement unionism, a labor movement that embraces and acts upon a bold vision of a moral economy. And I'll talk more about that toward the end of my remarks. I believe that to save the labor movement, we have to build a social movement union, not just in my country, but internationally. And that this is going to be an enormously difficult challenge. But first, before we get to that, let's explore the campaign itself. We began SeaTac in 2011 without the number 15 on our minds. The SeaTac campaign was an outgrowth of the SEIU Fight for a Fair Economy. Have people heard about that? Maybe not. It was an ambitious effort by my union to engage hundreds of thousands of low-wage workers across the country in the fight to build jobs and to organize workers on what was called an industrial scale rather than shop by shop. And this is the effort that also spawned a lot of the fast food campaigns in many cities. In Seattle, we visited thousands of low-wage workers and we met with airport workers, among them stuck in minimum wage jobs, just like the airport workers all around our country, my country, face. These are baggage handlers, cabin cleaners, fuelers, wheelchair attendants, shuttle drivers, car rental assistants, janitors, and more. In SeaTac, 4,000 workers in all, largely immigrant workers from all over the world. The jobs themselves were poverty traps. They paid the state minimum wage of less than $9 an hour. No one could afford the health benefits. Hours varied from week to week or even day to day, so workers couldn't do things like go back to school to pursue other careers. Management abuse of workers was rampant. Workers got fired for little reason or sometimes no reason at all. These workers from Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Ukraine, Russia, Mexico, the Philippines, Iraq, Iran, India, and so on, they were all stuck in a business model designed on purpose to stop organizing in its tracks. They didn't work for the airlines or the rental car companies directly, but rather for any number of minimum wage contract firms, which the parent company could switch out on short notice if workers began to agitate for better worker conditions. Now, I think the same thing is true at airports here as well. If workers managed to get over the hurdle of organizing, they found themselves stuck in this legal abyss. In the United States, airport workers are covered, logically, by the Railway Labor Act, which is a 1926 law, which only recognizes national bargaining units. So SeaTac cabin cleaners, for instance, could organize under the law only if they signed union cards along with a majority of 30,000 workers at more than 130 airports around the United States. So we knew we had to go outside the existing law in order to build power for workers. Workers united under the banner, "Make every airport job a good job," as you can see in that picture. We said we didn't care who the contractor was, the job should pay decently with benefits and stability, and all workers deserved union rights. And we focused pressure on Alaska Airlines since it was the dominant force at SeaTac Airport. Now, in the spring of 2013, dozens of workers, clergy, and community allies went to the managements of the main airport contract companies and Alaska Airlines calling for union recognition and negotiations. And here we are marching to the Alaska corporate headquarters, and Assad is actually the man in the tan jacket near the back there. Not surprisingly, Alaska and all the contractors refused negotiations, and we said then, okay, fine. If the companies won't negotiate contracts with us, then we're gonna have the voters impose work standards on them. And that's what led to the ballot initiative. CTAC Proposition 1 called for an immediate raise to $15 from $9.32 an hour. But we weren't the ones who came up with 15. We actually, the workers drew inspiration from the New York City fast food workers who had first hoisted the banner of 15 in the union. In the initiative, we also included paid sick leave, full-time hours for workers who wanted them, protection for workers to be able to hold on to their tips, and job security for contracted workers. In other words, if the airline decided to change contractors, the boss got fired, but all the workers kept their jobs. We also added in strong enforcement language the right to sue an employer for court and win not just your back wages, but interest and damages. It was a bold initiative with no phase-in periods for the wage increases and no half measures. The Seattle Times, which is our main newspaper in town, no friend of the working class, editorialized against the initiative, calling it a virtual union contract, and I had to agree with their assessment. We won the initiative, beating the airlines, the Chamber of Commerce, and all the other airport businesses that spent millions against us. But it took more than 2 years before Alaska Airlines and the Airport Commission lost their last court appeal, and workers got their full due. In addition to wages and benefits, beginning in early 2016, thousands of SeaTac workers won back pay settlements of $10,000. 20,000 and more. Just heard the other day of some workers who got $38,000 in back wages. Today, workers at SeaTac all have decent working conditions thanks to the initiative, and notably for me, below the radar of the mainstream media, the majority of them have now organized and won union contracts. There are important lessons about power in the SeaTac story, but for me, power is not an abstract discussion. We have to start with the grassroots activists whose insights really form the backbone of the book Beyond 15. Sarah Mahmood, the young woman I mentioned at the outset of my remarks, got involved in order to reunite her family. Her husband, William, was a minimum wage baggage handler for an Alaska Airlines contract firm, working double and even triple shifts just to pay the rent for their tiny apartment. Then one day after the contractor cut its already minimal vacation benefits, he came home and told Sarah, "I'm done, I just can't do it." A friend had told him about fishing jobs up in the Gulf of Alaska and took him to a waterfront hiring office. 2 days later, he was headed to a boat, working there 9 months out of the year, a world away from Sarah, his son, and a newborn daughter. Now Sarah was recruited to the SeaTac campaign by a union organizer, Yasmin Aden, herself a war refugee from Somalia. Yasmin had arrived in Seattle in 2000, hired on as a janitor, got involved in her union, led a wildcat strike at her building, and became an organizer on the SeaTac campaign. One day, Yasmin was knocking on an apartment complex just north of the airport, and she knocked on Sarah's door. She knew Sarah socially through the Somali community, but at first Sarah refused to get involved in the $15 campaign. Like many immigrant workers, she didn't want to raise a fuss. She felt fortunate enough to be in the United States. She didn't want to stir up trouble. But Yasmin persisted and she said, "You know, your kids don't get to see their dad." "You're right," Sarah acknowledged. She registered herself to vote for the first time and agreed to introduce Yasmin to her neighbors. The two ended up going through the apartment building the rest of the day, talking to workers, registering voters, and recruiting people to distribute information at the area mosques, small business shops, and community centers. Mohammed Kadim, the other person I mentioned, his family escaped Iraq in 2006, settling in Damascus. And there, Mohammed, who was a teenager, studied computer programming, but by 2010, it was no longer safe to be in that city. He landed in SeaTac and began working as a baggage handler for Delta Airlines in the rain without any protective gear or benefits. He was paid $9.50 an hour. One day, Yasmin met him at the airport, introduced by a cousin who also loaded bags. Yasmin showed him a chart comparing wages and benefits at SeaTac and at LAX, the main airport in Los Angeles, one of the few places where airport workers in the U.S. still had union rights. Mohammed was shocked by what he saw. The California workers serving the same customers, loading the exact same bags, working for the same airlines, made $6 an hour more, had benefits and union rights. Mohammed got involved organizing his fellow Iraqi workers for the initiative campaign. Today, the workers have 15 in a union contract, and Mohammed was actually able to leave the airport and go back to school and pursue his computing career. He's now working at a downtown IT firm in Seattle. Assad, the Tehran native, worked as a SeaTac wheelchair attendant along with workers from Ethiopia, the Philippines, Somalia, Samoa, and elsewhere. When language barriers made it impossible for him to have a full discussion about the union, he used hand gestures and symbols. And he used to say, one hand can't make any sound, but two hands can make a big noise. And people understood that, no matter where they were from. I met up with Assad last year, about a year and a half ago, after Alaska Airlines had lost its final court appeal. And gleefully, he showed me two consecutive pay stubs, one for $9.47 an hour, the state minimum wage, and the next for $15.24 an hour, the new inflation-adjusted minimum at SeaTac. In one fell swoop, his biweekly take-home pay had increased by several hundred dollars. And because of the initiative, he was also guaranteed full-time hours. What Sarah, Yasmin, Mohammed, Assad, and others understood was that SeaTac was about a lot more than $15. It was a bold bid to tilt power away from corporations and corporate elites who controlled the airport and back toward the community and workers. Recognizing the fight was about power meant that these workers also understood the need to organize in new ways, to build unity across cultural and language divides, to circumvent broken labor laws, to engage the entire community in the fight, not just those who worked at the airport. The central theme of my book is that our problem today isn't income inequality so much, although people in the mainstream media and many union folks like to define it as that. It's really power inequality. In my country today, we're engaged in a number of battles besides dealing with Trump every day. Healthcare, housing, human rights, civil rights, fighting school privatization. And I think these inequities that we identify in each of these areas are merely proxies for the bigger issues, the root cause to all these fights, which is the distribution of power in our society. Now, I don't mean to say that 15 is not a worthy fight. There's nothing wrong with the fight for 15. These campaigns ameliorate the worst of poverty, and they build vital worker confidence and leadership. But 15 doesn't solve our problems, and we need to be honest about that. It's not even a living wage in Seattle, Toronto, or most urban communities in North America. And it barely offsets the growing wealth disparity in at least my country. If you could get a national minimum wage in the United States of $15 an hour today, right up from $7.25, surely a political fantasy, but just go with me for a moment. It would reverse only about one-third of the growth in wealth disparity that occurred in just the 24 months between 2009 and 2011, the official end of the Great Recession. Even the SeaTac wage victory, proud as we are of it, doesn't undo the destruction of airport worker power since in the last generation. So for example, one of the leaders of the campaign, Alex Hoops, that's Alex carrying the banners on our right. His pay rose from $9.50 an hour. He's a baggage handler too. He worked alongside Mohammed Kadim. His pay rose from $9.50 before the initiative to more than $16 afterwards, which is great. He actually could buy a car now and not rely on an inadequate bus system. But back in 2005, Alex had been working as a baggage handler for Alaska Airlines, doing the exact same work at the airport. He had a union contract, benefits, and wages that today would be equivalent to $27 an hour. 2005, Alaska Airlines fired Alex and 471 of his coworkers, broke their union, and replaced them with a minimum wage contract company. So even after our win, Alex is paid $11 an hour less than what he ought to be making. The situation is hardly unique. You can, in my country at least, and probably yours as well, You can pick virtually any industry, auto, steel, transportation, food processing, publishing, whatever, and you can find countless examples of workers whose futures were destroyed by profit-seeking corporations. So we should absolutely celebrate victories like SeaTac, but let's put it in context of what capital has stolen from workers over the years. But too many movement leaders, I think, are averse to talking about this struggle in terms of power. Rather, they stick with the language of the tangible, healthcare, education, wages, and so on. And these are all good things, and we have to wage struggle based on tangible fights. But it's not sufficient, because if we see our work merely as being about fights, and what's the next issue fight we're gonna take on, then we're just fighting over the distribution of things rather than over who controls those distributional questions in the first place. In a movement of only tangible goals, it's natural for participants to lose any coherent sense of ideology and vision for our community, our country, and our world. We devolve to a transactional political movement of limited vision, just another special interest fighting with other special interest groups for stuff in the capitalist marketplace, not an inspiring movement driven by a vision of a moral economy. So let's, for a moment, set aside the SeaTac story and our present-day troubles with Trump, if that's possible, but let's try that, and look with a wider lens. And I think it's important, at least in the United States, certainly, to think about it this way. Think about the last 100 years as one giant bargaining table, with us on one side and big business on the other. Nearly a century ago, workers in the U.S., like ourselves, organized, built power, and exercised it in the core of the economy, manufacturing, right? Auto, steel, electrical, through strikes, sit-downs, mass marches, and other militant action, veterans' marches, right? Big business and their political allies, recognizing growing working power, worker power, made concessions to the working class to blunt militant action and head off demands for even more radical change. So we got legalization for unions and for many industrial workers, at least, notably the National Labor Relations Act of the 1930s excludes workers of color in agricultural and domestic work. But industrial workers got legal rights, collective bargaining. We got dues checkoff. We won union security protections. We won laws that mediated conflict in labor management relations, minimum wage and prevailing laws, social security, health and safety protections, and so on. Now, the gains our predecessors made beginning in the 1930s didn't come out of the benevolence or enlightenment of the business and political elites. There was this slogan in the 1930s, President Roosevelt wants you to join a union. Bullshit. Rather, these were all concessions to the power of mass sustained worker collective action and popular movements. Those of us in the union movement today need to recognize that our problems are much deeper than Trump in the White House or a hostile Congress or state legislatures that are stripping away basic worker rights. They're manifestations of a more profound phenomenon which spans Democratic and Republican administrations, which is that in the last few decades, business has withdrawn the concessions they made beginning in the 1930s. They've determined they no longer need to abide by these past agreements. And that's why we face such resistance in SeaTac, and that's why workers are walking picket lines down the road here at Ingersoll today. Because business recognizes that yesterday's bargain can be renegotiated. The hard truth is that even with outstanding examples of courage and fight, today's union movement, at least in my country, and I would reckon probably yours, and I need to learn more about it, today's movement is not capable of reversing the trend. And I want to identify four reasons, at least in my country, why this is so. First, the U.S. union movement is caught up in a vicious cycle of ebbing numerical strength translating into diminished political and economic clout. And I note that the decline is less steep here in Canada, but you are on the same trend line. Welcome. Second, most unions are constrained internally by limited vision and outmoded structures focused on defensive fights. Many union members, in turn, come to see their organization as an insurance policy against misfortune, not a vehicle for achieving hopes and dreams. Third, most unions operate today with a worker representation and collective bargaining model that works for many but fails to meet the interests and needs of a large and growing proportion of today's workforce: contingent contracted workers, independent contractors, workers who regularly move from one low-paying job to another, student workers, workers in the informal economy, and so on. And fourth, too many unions have become bureaucratized, failing to tap the true potential and wisdom of their rank and file members. All this for me adds up to a profound existential crisis for working people in America. And I see responses from union leaders and activists falling into three general categories. And I think leaders in particular, but I don't want to just say it's about leaders, it's also about activists who fall into some of these categories as well. In the first category are people who are absolutely paralyzed by the political landscape. They have no plan. They stay busy negotiating contracts for their existing members, processing grievances the way they have for years on end, advocating politically in the same old way, relying on the same old Democratic Party for salvation, and hoping that we can somehow manage our way through the next 4 years. I met up recently with a friend of mine who's on staff with a large West Coast public sector local in the US. And I asked, how's your union getting ready for Janus? You know, people, Janus is the Supreme Court case that within a year is going to outlaw union shops throughout the United States. We're not getting ready, he said. We're going to lose 20% of our members off the top. His leadership is entirely demobilized, shocked by the political landscape, incapable of figuring out a way forward. And frankly, too many of them are looking at what their pension payouts are going to be in the next few years, and they're solely focused on how do they protect that. In my Seattle, progressive Seattle, the Seattle that you hear so much good stuff about, we have a Central Labor Council, which has had good leadership and still does in many ways. Central Labor Council, many unions who have just endorsed a multimillionaire for mayor, whose campaign is bankrolled by the core of the business establishment. Not only that, but they've gone on to endorse the incumbent commissioner for the Port of Seattle, who went to court with Alaska Airlines to fight us on 15 and SeaTac. And they've endorsed her for re-election. When pressed, the union leaders explained that the candidates have promised to back workers. They've given an agreement to this union. They've promised something else to another union. This is amazing. I mean, have we learned nothing from the last year? So people are demobilized or paralyzed. The second category, we find people who recognize the need to act, but they're looking for shortcuts. These are people who propose policy fixes, invest heavily in political saviors, try to cut top-down deals with business to avert disaster. And in many communities, this will allow for the near-term survival of unions as institutions, but it won't save our labor movement. I want to just call out one example. At one extreme, we see leaders who've given up entirely on worker power. In my home state, the leader of the largest SEIU local, a guy named David Rolfe, some of you have heard of him, wrote an article after last November's election entitled, "Unions Aren't Coming Back." Talk about defeatism. Instead, he's proposing clever policy fixes like portable health benefits and portable vacation benefits for gig economy workers to be managed by the nonprofit industry, or even he suggests maybe by the banks. In the name of innovation, he raises some interesting policy ideas. I think portable benefits are a worthy discussion. But rather than collective action to win these things, he'd like to see unions partner with Silicon Valley venture capital firms and make closed-door deals with Uber and Airbnb. And this is not innovation, this is capitulation. You have to be clear about that. The third response that we see recognizes that our fight is about power and that the idea of a union, the simple idea of workers uniting in action to fight for the things that they need, remains the essential foundation in the fight for a just society. Even with the changing nature of work, from large industrial sites to dispersed workplaces, from 7 to 3 job shifts to on-demand scheduling, from direct employment to franchising and contracting, the unchanging truth is that it's the brain and muscle of workers that creates all wealth and value in the economy, and that our power lies in collectively resisting systemic exploitation and advancing bold demands. That doesn't mean that workers have to be strike ready at every moment. It simply means that workers have to recognize what bosses everywhere know, which is that creative exercise of worker power is unstoppable. In SeaTac, after Alaska Airlines refused negotiations, we said, fine, we'll exert our power through the community at the ballot box. In my city and in other cities, Uber workers have periodically gone on short-term strikes to win rate changes. Undocumented workers in the United States collectivized their worker power by forming worker centers and establishing minimum pay and safety standards for dispatch to jobs in the area. In North Carolina and beyond, the Moral Mondays movement, fusing direct action, including mass civil disobedience, with a spiritually based call for justice, is inspiring new activists and building powerful alliances. Just this past weekend, it was really inspiring to see hundreds of professional athletes, along with countless fans, take collective action and deliver a stunning rebuke to Trump's latest racist outrage, and so on. I don't think there's a single template to building collective worker power. In every situation, you have to assess the circumstances, identify your allies, your adversaries, and use whatever tools you have available. And you continually fight the temptation for easy ways to build power, political shortcuts, and so on, because there are no shortcuts in this fight. There's no question this is going to be extremely difficult. Desperate times can be killing fields for risk-taking, and yet creativity, risk-taking, and disruption on a broad basis are precisely what we need to do. In Beyond 15, I describe what a renewed labor movement, this social movement union, some people call a social justice union, should look like. I use 3 metaphors to describe its essential qualities: aim higher, reach wider, and build deeper. First, on aim higher, we need to build a labor movement that offers a bold vision of a just society, a stark counterpoint to capitalism. Beyond 15 shows how corporate and political elites of both major political parties deliberately destroyed tens of thousands of good airport jobs so they could maximize profits. You can look at virtually any other industry in our economy and see the same developments in the last 2 generations. The growing divide in our country is not an accident or misfortune or a product of global trade or technology or inadequate training, but rather a deliberate design of the 1%. To quote the Chicago Teachers Union, it is broke on purpose for workers. A big lesson from SeaTac for me is that the social movement union has to be more than political. It must draw upon the values that emanate from our deepest human emotions and desire for justice. We did this intervention at the 2013 Alaska Airlines shareholders meeting, where a dozen clergy took over the meeting and led a prayer for worker justice. And we bought shares. I'm an owner of Alaska Airlines. I own 1 share, and other airport workers did, and organizers and clergy and so on. And the ministers, let me show you, here's a picture of them leading a prayer at the Alaska Airlines shareholders meeting. What happened is we went in there, and 5 minutes before the meeting was to begin, the ministers went up front, and John Helmer, the tall minister there in the middle, said, I've been asked by some of the shareholders to lead a prayer. And the executives thought it was part of the program. So much so that we had an organizer who was shuffling papers in the aisle, and an executive turned, shh, they're doing a prayer now. And John said, you know, let's give thanks for everyone in this room, and we have a tremendous power. This is a very successful company, and we're very you know, and so people were drawn in. And he said, let us, you know, pray for justice, and let's make this company a beacon of justice for workers and the community, and let's save ourselves from the gravity of greed and the snares of selfishness. And then they sat down. Ministers were so deft about this. Some of the executives, as I mentioned, thought it was part of the program. But in issuing the prayer, the clergy were connecting material demands to spiritual values, shifting the debate from dollars and cents to core human values. And there, and in meetings and marches through the airport, we saw workers gain confidence when they marched with clergy because they saw how it reframed the campaign around justice. So we have to aim higher. Secondly, the social movement union has to reach wider. We have to reject the historic definition of the labor movement as comprising only workers who are members of unions, and instead embrace the full spectrum of the working class and working class-based organizations. Now, today, we have groups fighting foreclosures, we have tenant rights organizations, advocates for ending homelessness, worker centers, immigrant rights groups, parents standing up for public education, people fighting police brutality, Black Lives Matter, civil rights groups, healthcare advocacy groups, faith institutions, all of these and more, along with workplace unions, are organized expressions of the interests of working people. These are essential building blocks of a powerful labor movement. Workplace unions need to embrace these groups as unions in the community, part of the core of the labor movement. I want just a brief story. I remember talking to the leader of the worker center in our community, Casa Latina. And this is a place where undocumented day laborers, most of whom from Central America, come every day and they get dispatched to jobs. And because they've organized in the community, they've actually achieved the minimum of, a year ago, $16 an hour for maintenance work, landscaping, construction work, and domestic work, and so on. Actually, 16 is the minimum. It goes up from there. And the workers, like at other worker centers, they all contribute dues. They pay money into the worker center to help keep it going. They put money into a social insurance fund if somebody gets picked up by immigration. Somebody has a healthcare crisis, if somebody has a funeral they have to pay for, right? So they contribute to that. They have a worker committee that has decided how to work dispatch and democratically decide how to run Casa Latina. And I remember we were just sort of chatting informally, he says, well, of course, we're not a union. It's like, well, wait, how are you different from a union? That a big part of the obstacle of how we see the labor movement is how we define it. That the boundaries of solidarity that we define by calling the union by calling the labor movement simply workplace unions really limits the solidarity of our class. So, thirdly, the social movement union has to build deeper by cultivating the ideas and leadership of workers. It has to embrace the principle and practice of authentic worker engagement and leadership. And in most U.S. unions today, this is far too rare, and that may be a bit of an understatement even. Professional union organizers like myself are trained to regard workers as people to be influenced, persuaded, moved into actions. They're viewed as instruments to be activated for the benefit of a greater institutional goal that the workers themselves may have only vaguely bought into. Most of what passes for worker involvement today just touches the surface of tapping true worker intelligence and leadership. Now at CTAC, we were far from perfect in this regard, but when we honored the central role of workers as co-authors of their economic and social liberation, when we engaged their ideas, we built a more powerful campaign. I describe in the one book how in my book, how one worker, cabin cleaner by the name of Samatar Abdullahi, confronted me at one point to say that in his view, we lacked a coherent strategy, that it was time to form unions in the workplace and demand recognition. This is in 2012. The SEIU headquarters staff back in D.C. were skeptical, and they said the workers aren't ready for this step, and we shouldn't do it. But we took Samatar's advice, and it turned out to be exactly the right strategy. So in conclusion, I'll say it's going to take wrenching change to transform today's labor movement. And yet one of the key lessons for me from SeaTac is that the elements of this new social movement union are everywhere around us. They're embedded in the daily struggles of working people, whether it's the examples I described from the US or the tremendous strike that you had here, the Unite Here members, and all the support that the workers got from students and faculty and others. Our job is to learn from these struggles, replicate their successes, and combine them in ever more ambitious efforts as we build a labor movement of the 99%. By nature, these efforts will claim new strategies, they will disrupt norms and conventions, they'll make it uncomfortable, not just for politicians and corporate executives that we need to take on, but also for allies within the labor movement who are accustomed to doing things a certain way and think we can't or mustn't do too much to disrupt our own habits or the system as it currently exists. Some of this experimentation is going to take place within existing unions where there's the political latitude to do that, but more of it will take place outside of traditional unions in immigrant rights movements, Black Lives Matter, environmental justice campaigns, workers organizing in the informal and gig economies, the Moral Mondays movement, and so on. It's all part of the messy, dynamic, creative reimagining of the labor movement. In SeaTac, we challenge workers, clergy, and community supporters to step outside their comfort zones, to break conventions and laws, to confront worker power, corporate power with worker power, and to imagine a dramatically different world. We insisted on it because we knew the alternative was guaranteed misery and despair. Likewise, it's incumbent on all of us to learn from that, whether in academia or in union leadership or rank and file roles, to challenge ourselves in the same way, to recognize the fierce urgency of this moment, to break habits and conventions, to imagine a powerful new labor movement that claims a moral vision, and to start building it today. Thank you very much.
All right.